I feel much better today. Love thank God.
Radio.
Good afternoon. It's beautiful outside, and Hurricane Matthew is a thing of our past. We had him yesterday. Those of us in New York, we just loved him visiting and giving us pouring rain and thunder and all the rest of it. And thank God he's going to leave Florida and hope he never comes back. So the sun is shining, and this is going to be really a fantastic show because we have award-winning authors that write the best of anybody that I've ever read. So we've got the author of The Thin Black Line, and I'm reading the new his new book, Thin Red Line, and that's Simon Gervais. Hi, Simon.
Hi, friend. How are you?
Okay, hanging in there. And the guy that's going to write the next Michael Torrione thriller, that's just because I'm hinting. Ha ha, I like him. he's one of the best authors, and he writes the Caitlin Strong mysteries. And my sister-in-law is waiting for me to give her the book again because she loved the other three that I gave her. That would be John Land. How you doing?
I'm doing good, but you got to tell her she's got to pay. She's got to go buy one for herself.
I told her that too. They don't.
I'm a struggling author. We can't be giving away our books, right?
That's what I said about my own too, and they still say, "Give me a copy." What can I say? And he's the author of The Italian Divide, and yes, my hairdresser read it. The other guy there read it, and my cousin wants it, and she's not getting it because anybody that puts me, you know, gives me a quote in the book, they don't get the book. I get to keep it. That's too bad. So that's Alan Topol. How you doing?
I'm wonderful, Fran. Thanks a lot for having me, and enjoy being with your fellow authors today.
This is great, and I can't wait for your next books to come out. I've got 75 books inside that are staring at me, and they're going to stare a little longer because, like I said, the science for pleasure comes first. So this is Double Plot Monday, and I thought this would be interesting because among a whole bunch of other panel shows that I've created in my brain, and when creating your novels, how do you decide on creating that double plot? How do you decide, where to put the character? In other words, you have plots and subplots, and some of you have two major plots. How do you decide how to do that? Because most people don't know how to do that.
For me, and this is John Land, for me with the Caitlin Strong books, I hate to use the word formula, but it's kind of what I do in every book. There's always a primary plot that's set in the present where Texas Ranger Caitlin Strong is trying to figure out what's going on and what terrible thing is going to happen. Somehow, in every one of the books in the series, there's a thread, a subplot set in the past in which one of her ancestors, who was a Texas Ranger, her father, grandfather, great-grandfather, or great-great-grandfather, was following up a different kind of investigation, but one that parallels hers and ultimately intersects. So in the case of the Caitlin Strong series, Caitlin needs to figure out what happened in the past in order to figure out what's going to happen in the present.
I think that's really cool, John, that you this is Simon, by the way, that you're able to do that. I guess you need a lot of research to be able to do what type of police investigations were conducted in the past, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, Simon, in testament to you, there's a Royal Canadian Mounted Policeman in Strong Cold Dead.
I like that. Thank
and
you.
I was thinking of you when I wrote him.
You know, you can always call and ask me questions. I'll be always
no,
more than
but then
happy
I'll
to
have to be accurate. I'll have to be credible. I rather just make it up and hope I get it right. No, actually, I think Simon, what you say is so vital because including stuff in the past means the guns have to be the right guns.
Mm-hmm.
The clothes have to be made out of the right material. What I try to do, and this is where, Fran, I have the most fun. I try to incorporate historical figures into the threads that take place in the past to make the books more fun and to give them a relevance that thrillers don't ordinarily get. For example, in Strong Cold Dead, the villain in the historical subplot, the historical thread, is John D. Rockefeller. And I had so much fun portraying John D. Rockefeller, and this goes to Simon's point, pretty much exactly as he really was. He wasn't a nice guy at all. I fictionalized the fact that he came to Texas on the trail of oil on Indian reservation land, because that's kind of dramatic license. If he wasn't in the oil business at all, it wouldn't have worked. But the fact is, this period of history that I'm writing about, the 1870s, was the beginning of Standard Oil. It was the beginning of the robber barons, who, of course, basically ran the country for 50 years or so, Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan and Carnegie, and none of them were really nice guys. And it's fun in these books. Another book, in Strong Darkness, I used Judge Roy Bean. In the next Caitlin Strong book I'm working on now, J. Edgar Hoover comes to Texas. So, this is the fun of setting stuff in the past, because it allows you to incorporate, to cross that line between fact and fiction. Speculative history is the way, or you know, kind of, it's what Brad Meltzer, Steve Barry and Jim Rollins do, but Steve Barry and Brad Meltzer do it better than anyone. They kind of reinvent and reimagine the way history happened by putting people in different roles. And when we write fiction, when we write thrillers, it's just another element that makes them fun.
Well, I always look up your past history, the flashback to whatever, Judge Roy Bean or whatever. So in order to write your review, so make sure that I'm credible, I do the history, I do the back, you know, I look it up also.
This is Fran, it's Alan. This is such an interesting question you're raising, because as you know, and I'm sort of picking up where John was, as you know, in all of my books, is I'm trying to weave in not just current events in a geopolitical sense, but history of a place, so that in the newest book, The Italian Divide, the history of Italy, namely the conflict between the North and the South, and the fact that they had been basically two separate entities until the middle of the 19th century and still retain those kind of animosities, becomes pivotal to the whole story. And so it's always a complex matter. How do you weave in that history? Because I want the reader to learn something, in this case, about the history of Italy. And I think John made a good point a second ago, which I'll echo, is it has to be relevant to the plot. You have to tie it into the plot. So in the context here, that background's critical for what's happening now in an Italian political situation. So I think
That's difficult, because most authors can't do it. As a matter of fact, sometimes when people flash back, which is my next question, is that the reader can't follow it. Because when you flash back, you flash back in the next chapter, and I know where to start. And yet sometimes people flash back in the middle of a page, and that makes it hard. So how do you know exactly when to flash back so that the plots in the past and the present, you know, they collide, but they don't collide so that the reader, like me, doesn't get confused?
This is Simon Fran, and I usually don't do any flashbacks in my book. I start at point A, I call it, and at the end of the book, I'm at point Z. I don't go back in history. I tell the story like it is. I want it to feel like if somebody was watching a Jack Bauer movie. That's what I want. I'm not doing any flashback, and I know it works great for many authors, but for me, so far, I haven't done any. And I'm presently researching my book that's going to come out in November 2017 called Tick, Crimson Line. And I'm going to have a small flashback, but it's going to be a prologue, and we're going to go back to Iran when the Shah was outed by the new regime with Khomeini. So that's going to be the first time, but it's only going to last for about two pages, and then I'm going to move forward. I have a tremendous respect for people like Alan and John that can do back and forth. But for me personally, I found that I was taking too much time researching because, like John said, and everything you write, it's really credible because I'm sure he spends tons of time researching the backstories and the other elements of his story. As I always try, though, to talk about the present because I feel that my readership – that's what they want, and that's what they're asking for. So I'm doing my best to provide it to them. For me, the type of story I write, I feel that it would slow the story down a little bit if I had flashback.
You know, it's an excellent point. And you just, Simon, you just made me think of something. The difference between what I do with the historical thread and the flashback, and I'm not sure if this is accurate. I wish we had Steve Berry on the phone or Brad Meltzer, because they're, like I said, or MJ Rose, who also does this kind of book very well. And here's what I'm thinking. A flashback, by definition, would seem to refer to going back in the character's past that you're telling the story about. So in other words, I would flash back to Caitlin 20 years ago. That's a flashback. What I do really aren't flashbacks. They're separate threads. In the sense that the historical characters, because they're living so in the past, they have no interaction. These aren't people who exist in the present, and we see what they were doing in the past. This is an entire independent story that unfolds within the course of the book. That in order for that other, and here's the other thing, they aren't flashbacks in the sense that they're just stuck in there. Every time I do one of these cutaways, one of these dissolves, which is what the film, what they would be called if this were a film, it's always a character who's telling another character the story of what's going on. So I try, and this goes exactly to your point, Simon, I try to keep them organic to the story by always having the characters relaying information to each other that's crucial to solve what's going on in the present by understanding what happened in the past. It's the same thing. I don't use the third person. I don't believe you do either. I don't think Alan does. The third person omniscient narrator. I never use that. Every single scene in my books is done from the point of view of a character. So when I think it's time to insert one of my historical the next part chronologically of the historical thread, I have a character say, well, that remind, I won't, this is really funky, but that reminds me of what happened to your great-great-grandfather back all those years ago, ... And then we cut to the chapter that's the historical thread. Then when the next chapter following that takes us back to the same person who's been telling the story. So that creates a kind of easy weave of the past and the present. And Fran, I think that goes to the point you were getting at before of how it is not to disrupt the narrative flow of the story by disrupting the structure by jumping back and forth in time so much. If you make it organic, it doesn't feel like you're jumping around at all.
Absolutely, John.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right, because I was reading something, I won't tell you which book, and all of a sudden I'm going, wait a minute, I could swear they were talking about this character, and all of a sudden they're talking about another one, and then on the next page they were talking about something else. I go, it's a good thing I have my graphic organizer out, because otherwise probably my review would have been all over the place. I mean, it's very confusing when somebody does that. Plus,
well, I think that the editor, at the point, I think you'll agree with me, Alan and John, that the editor should step in at the point. If a writer does that, I think it's poor craft. You really need to make sure that the readers will be able to follow the story without any problem. That's definitely an issue. And I want to make sure that if I do that, my editor is going to let me know before the book goes to press.
You know,
they don't,
I think
come always. Is that Alan Jacobson on the phone now? Are you here?
It is.
Alan Jacobson has joined us.
Oh,
hello,
good.
Everybody.
The question, Alan, is when you create a second plot or you go flashback in time, how do you keep it from not confusing the reader within the first plot? Because people flash back and forth in time in the middle of a page, on the next page, on three pages down. So we're just talking about how you keep the plot flowing when you create that. So, John, keep going.
No, I was just going to say, and this was this because I think this is something Alan does,
yeah.
Pretty sure. I think to get to that point, there are two thoughts. One, because we're getting a little technical here, but I know your audience appreciates that. I use time and date stamps, you know, so you know where you are in every chapter. And if we flash back, I give you the time stamp of where we're going.
Yeah.
One of the things that e-readers have given us, and before that, what Michael Crichton and James Patterson gave the thriller genre, was the trend toward much shorter chapters. My Caitlin Strong books normally have about 105 chapters, which are just individual. Instead of jumping, packaging scenes within chapters, each chapter stays with the same character for the most part. There are some diversions from that. But that way, it's much easier to keep up with time and place, because every time I change setting and point of view, it's another chapter. And there's another stamp of where a time and date stamp at the top of the chapter, which tells us where and when we are.
Yeah, I do the same thing with the date, time and date stamp. I think it's really important, because otherwise, depending upon how complex the storyline is, it can get confusing. When I wrote Spectrum, which was came out 2 years, 2.5 years ago, we had three different timelines. So there was a historic. Yeah, it was a challenge. So not only did we use date and timestamps, we used fonts to help the reader along, because it was something from the 70s, something from the 90s, and something from the present day. So the font in the time and date stamp was very representative of the time period. So that helped a little bit too. Anything you can do to help the reader follow along. Plus, my feeling was the three storylines were so different in terms of time and period. And I also tried to make sure that I gave the reader a sense of the time, whether it be a song from the 70s, there was something from the Apollo program, so they were watching one of the Apollo landings in one of the chapters from the 70s. So anything that you can do to bring the reader to that sense of time visually and content-wise, I think helps and keeps them locked into what's going on in the story and where you are as a reader.
You did, because when in Spectrum, I was really glad that you gave us the backstory about Karen Vale, because otherwise I wouldn't
fun.
Have known. That was
yeah.
fun, and that was interesting. I love that character, by the way. She's one of my favorites. But I like knowing how she got there and how by accident she got on a murder case, and that was really good. And the fact that she's not perfect, and on all these stories, none of them are perfect, the main character gets in trouble, so that makes me feel like there's hope in the world for just about anybody to get anywhere. That's great. So my next question is, this is an odd one, would you ever place yourself in the other time period and see how you would react before writing the stories? Do you ever place yourself in the time period that you're going to write in or in the scene you're going to write in?
Well, this is Simon Frank. I think I can say that, as you know, my characters are former federal agents like I used to
yeah.
be. So I know what I'm writing about, especially in the thin black line and a red dotted line. So I know exactly how the of course, what I do is that I do figure that I'm the hero of the action, and I'm saying to myself, what would Simon do if he was caught in that situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it helped me out through most of the tactical challenges I had writing the book. And if, for example, it's not something I was good at, for example, I'm not a sniper. And I do have a couple of snipers seen in my next book. Well, I do have a good friend that's one of the top five in Canada. So I can call him, and he's going to tell me exactly what he would do in that situation. that's the way I deal with it. Because as you know, as I said, I don't have flashback. I don't have different timeline. For me, it's always in the present, and it moves forward from then. But, yes, I do place myself in my character's shoes and to try to determine the best way of action.
Yeah, Alan Jacobson here. I do try to put myself in that time period, and you know, as much as possible. Whether it's sitting in a car from the 1950s when I wrote MA 1577, there were scenes that occurred in the 1950s as well as you know that moved forward from that point as well as the present time. And so you know, I would sit in a 1950s car when I would. You know, write those scenes in the 50s, or I'd, you know, have music playing from the 50s. I think it does help to put yourself in that mindset when you're creating that world for the reader at the time.
If I can add something, Fran, as well, Simon again, what I'd like to do as well is sit. Let's say I write a scene in Lisbon, Portugal, in one of my books. I'd like, if at all possible, to write that scene while I'm actually in Portugal or Italy. That's why I travel so much, because I like, let's say I'm in Greece, and then my next book, A Red Dotted Line, there's a scene that's in Mykonos, Greece. Where do you think I wrote that scene? I was right there, so I can look around me. I feel the wind on my skin. I can smell, you know, the bread being baked next door. So I think it brings validity to the book when somebody's lucky enough to be able to do that. When you look around you, you actually feel that you're there, and I hope that the readers will feel the same, that my words are going to translate well on the page.
Yeah, I really want
that.
I think
you
this is
that.
A
Alan
great
Helpel
point.
You see that, Alan Helpel does that too.
Absolutely. This is such a great point that you just made, because in all my books, they're international based, and with the exception of having been stopped because of a war from going somewhere in the Middle East, I've been to all the places, and the comment that just was made is so good. You have to have that sense of place. You have to feel it. And there's no substitute for having been there. Now, these days with the internet, it's amazing how much information you can obtain. I mean, somebody was writing a screenplay to adapt one of my novels, and they describe this setting in the lobby of the Bristol Hotel in Paris, which is in the novel, where I've been a number of times, and they describe it so accurately in the elevator. And I said to them, gee, when were you there? And the screenwriter says, oh, I wasn't. I got all this information on the internet. And you can go very, very far with the internet. But I still agree with the comment that was just made. There's nothing like being there to feel it, to absolutely smell it, to sort of taste the place. And it just, I mean, that I think it helps you so much in writing. It really, really does. So if your listeners want to write international locales, please, if they can arrange it and afford it, I would encourage them to get on an airplane and go.
Yeah, no, Alan Jacobson here. I agree completely. It's something I do as well. It makes it very difficult because, as the other Alan can tell you, when you're writing international scenes and you have to go to these places, it not only gets expensive, but it's very time-consuming. So you could try to write as well on the flights to and from. But, you know, you land, you know, you're spending a good 10 days there to get the flavor of the city, to scout out your locations, to walk the places where your characters are going to be walking, see the culture, and as Alan said, smell and hear and taste the food and go inside the places. You know, you could do a lot with Google Earth and Bing Maps to see exteriors. You can also see some interiors, but it's tougher to see the interiors. And, you know, sometimes you can see when somebody has been in a place by the fact that there will be a lot of exterior detail, but the interiors of some of the buildings is lacking. And that's because, you know, they weren't actually there. And, you know, look, you can't not every person can go every place and see every spot that they're writing about. But I think it does make a difference in terms of the reality for the writer and therefore also for the reader.
A trick that I have, Fran, this is Simon again, is to invest into a GoPro. My wife and I spent a little bit more than 2 weeks in Europe to research the next book, the 2017 one. And I think we got over 100 hours of footage about, you know, Little Street in Venice. And then you go to Greece and you go to France and you do the same thing and you take pictures and you take notes. I have, like I said, over 100 hours of video and about 100 pages of notes that I took while I was there. So sometimes if I cannot write, because, you know, life happens. You're with the kid, you're with your wife. You cannot always write every scene where you're at. But then you can go back on your computer. You put the little disc, and then you can look at the video that you took. You can look at the notes, and it brings back memory that if you've been there, you can still do it from home.
That's amazing.
Funny,
John,
funny
I have a question just for you.
Oh, go ahead.
John,
yes.
Here's my question. I think if I can find it on my paper now. Did your last book work with ISIS? Caitlin is dealing with ISIS. If she could tell you how to handle the storyline, what would she tell you that she has to do in order to take care of the situation with ISIS? So I have a question for each author separate.
Shoot every one of them.
I was hoping to send Matthew there too.
I think the Texas Rangers. I think when you're a gunfighter and. What I try to do with these Caitlin Strong books is really draw Caitlin, is fashion Caitlin as a modern-day gunslinger. And her code is very simple when it comes to bad guys. And the reason why I chose ISIS, I mean, first off, the book before, I went from the Chinese to the Russians to ISIS, and the next book is neo-Nazis. So I'm going to run out of these kind of villains eventually. You know, what are you going to do? But here's why I wanted to do it. You notice it's like every time there's a tragedy, and there's so many of them. It seems like there's one a week. And you look at France, and you look at San Bernardino, and you look at Orlando, and you look – just pick any of them. The one time a disaster was – a catastrophe – was averted was when those three Marines, two Marines and a third non-Marine, were on a train in France. They just happened to be on that train when somebody with a gun started coming up the aisle, and they took them down. And because of that, dozens of lives were saved. And it made me think, why can just when a crazy guy is in a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, why isn't there a Navy SEAL in the audience who happens to be packing? Why isn't Caitlin Strong around when something really bad is about to happen? We make our heroes projections of what we want to have happen. Out in Alan's neck of the woods in Northern California, when the Zodiac killer was at large, there was graffiti everywhere, Dirty Harry. Where are you when we need you? And that referring to the fictional character played by Clint Eastwood in the movie set in that region, in San Francisco. So Caitlin, as a gunfighter, as a modern-day Wyatt Earp, a modern-day Wild Bill Hickok, Bat Masterson, the list goes on. She is a projection of just once she's in the right place, someone like her is in the right place at the right time to stop something catastrophic from happening. And I think to an extent all thrillers are projections. They're kind of interactive adventures where the audience is trying to figure out what's going on as they play along with the characters. So you want to give them this opportunity. It's like, why couldn't Jack Reacher be so? You know, it's not just Caitlin Strong. Why not Jack Reacher? When Jack Reacher's in a bar and bad guys come in, nothing bad happens because he takes the bad guys out. But in real life, that doesn't happen. Or if it does happen, as I alluded to, it doesn't happen often enough.
It doesn't. But Alan Jacobson, how would Karen Vale handle? She's new on the force. I mean, no, she's not that new anymore. And she's tough, and she has a good backup team. So how would she be able to handle a terrorist task force and go after them? What do you think she would do? Because she's a good character.
Well,
I could see her doing that.
Yeah, so Vale has her own series. She's an FBI profiler, and her backstory is an FBI agent and an NYPD detective, and before that an NYPD patrol officer. So she's kind of run the gamut of all different types of, you know, by-the-book investigations. Mm-hmm. But I've also introduced her into the OPSIC Team Black covert ops series. And, you know, part of the reason for doing that is she's a fish out of water. And anytime you can do that with your character, I think it's a positive stress. It stresses me as the writer to see her in different ways and put her in different situations. And that's a positive for the reader as well. So, you know, Vale now has, you know, amassed some considerable experience in terms of not just by the book investigations, but being in these situations where she is staring down a terrorist and she does have to face these people. I think she would do what needs to be done at the time. As John said, you know, if that means you shoot the bad guy, she's going to shoot him. There was a scene in the very first Karen Vale series where she's in a bank and she's you know, basically she's got this hostage, and it comes off, and she's fairly early in her career at that point, and it comes off where she ends up shooting the person, and it's a very quick scene, and she's reprimanded for it because it didn't unfold, you know, perhaps the way it normally would, where, you know, you back away, you try to talk him down. She tries to talk him down very quickly. He's not having any of it. This woman is at risk, this his hostage, and she basically, you know, takes the initiative and does shoot him, and it's not taken very well by her superiors, but she feels she did the right thing. And ultimately she did, you know, if you take, you know, procedure out of it and protocol. But yeah, she would definitely not hesitate to, you know, to do what needs to be done, just as John and Caitlin Strong would.
Simon, I have an honest question for you. Your husband and wife team that I love, and I'm reading your new book, in between reading like a whole bunch more, but I'm reading it. And I like what they did to Zima. I thought that was hilarious at the beginning of the book, making her feel like she didn't belong on the team. That was hilarious, by the way. I loved it. I said,
well,
no, they wouldn't really do that.
Right. Yes, they would, because when you're in these type of operations, like I've been, as you know, I've been in the military before. I was an infantry officer, then I spent 15 years as a federal agent with the RCMP. And what we do, especially in very specialized units, we always tag ourselves. We don't take ourselves too seriously, and we keep joking around all the time. And I thought it was a good way for me to bring Zima in the fold, was to make her feel unwelcome. You know, because she did her she did her stuff. She passed all the tests. But then again, before she's really accepted, we're gonna make fun of her, because this is how we do it in real life. We always make fun of other people. But of course, when it's time to be put the business face on, we always do. But before that, it's always jokes and fun. And I wanted to include that in the book, and I thought it was a nice touch, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did. I said, oh, you didn't really do that. I go, yeah, she did. She sort of had it coming. You never know. But your husband and wife team has dealt with some difficult terrorists and watched their family die. How do you think they would handle another incident at the airport or train if they had to do that over again? And do you think they would have done something different? Because Lisa could kick herself for not being there, and he was on a plane. So how do you think they would change that if they could, or handle it again?
I'm not sure how they would, honestly, and that's what I love about my characters. As you're reading A Red Dotted Line and A Long Gray Line just before, you see that Lisa Walton's character is evolving. Mm-hmm. She used to be a medical doctor, really strict, really severe, really concentrated and dedicated to saving people's lives. But when she lost her whole family, she had a mental breakdown. And, you know, Mai had to pick her up in pieces and rebuild her. And now she's one of the most lethal operative after, of course, a long training that she got into a 10 black line. So now Mike actually has to keep her on leash because she doesn't have the experience he has, but she's really good at what she does. So to put her back in the same scenario as the beginning of the 10 black line, I honestly don't know how she would react. It would be a lot of fun for me to write Lisa's character back into this situation, because right now, as you can see in a red dotted line, you know, sometimes she acts too quickly. She doesn't assess everything before committed 100% to an action plan. So for me to bring her back to Ottawa 2 years ago, I'm not exactly sure how she would react, to be honest. I know how Mike would do it. He would do exactly what he did the first time around. But Lisa, that would be interesting.
Yeah, she does. She does jump the gun and gets in trouble. So, Alan Topol, question. Craig Page deals with terrorists and CIA and FBI, but he also was a race car driver. Which does he really want to be? And would he ever want to do something as a race car driver to solve a crime? Because I loved him as a race car driver, by the way.
Well, he got really – race car driving is something, as you know, having read the books, Fran, that Craig Page always wanted to do, and he never could. He ended up in the CIA, and then he ended up head of counterterrorism, and he had this dream sort of in back. And then when, as a result of his conflict with the Chinese brothers, he was forced to take on a new identity, extensive plastic surgery, a new identity, and he was getting out of the counterterrorism game entirely. And at long last, he was going to do what he wanted to do. He was going to become a race car driver. And so he was doing that and really kind of thoroughly enjoying it. He had a benefactor, a banker in Milan, and it's only when that banker in Milan ends up becoming murdered that Craig then gets drawn back into the counterterrorism game. And so he ends up then working back. It revolves him in, and so his two lives kind of at that point. And I love doing it because I love him, this other activity. And the two are consistent because, as Elizabeth tells him, damn it, Craig, you have a death wish. And she almost yearns for him to be back into the counterterrorism business because the risks would be less for him than they are in race car driving, where he's already had one serious accident. So in both, it's playing to his gutsy, courageous, go-for-broke sort of attitude. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I got
and
it. So I have, I have another question.
Go ahead.
Well, I've got tons of them, people.
go ahead.
I've got enough for like three more shows here. When creating an ending to one of your novels, do you leave them open-ended so the characters can, you know, revisit where they left off? Would you place them in danger so everybody knows there's more to come? And I'm still waiting for Michael Turio.
I heard that. I think every book in a series needs to be entirely self-contained. So they all read standalone.
Yes.
I don't think I've ever started a series at the very beginning. I mean, I've always gone. I think I picked up Lee Child in the middle. I picked up James Lee Burke in the middle. When I was a kid, I picked up James Bond in the middle and then started reading them in order because it was a lot more fun. I think it is a lot of fun with series to read them in order, especially if the characters grow and evolve. In some cases, characters don't change. They don't age. They stay the same. In the case of Caitlin Strong, for example, though, she evolves emotionally because you see the kids she's become, the teenage boys of her reformed outlaw boyfriend, Court Wesley Masters, they're growing up. In every book, they're about a year older. So I need to age her chronologically, which is a lot of fun if you read the series in order. If you don't, and if I was dependent on all people reading, starting with the first one, I'd never sell, none of us would ever sell the later entries in our series. We want people to pick up the latest one and not feel they've left, they've lost anything, or they need to know anything, that they have it. So I think when you read, and I did that once, and I probably will regret it, leaving an ending open-ended is kind of like not being served dessert for dinner, after dinner. You don't feel fulfilled. You don't get the payoff. You don't get a sense of closure. And you also feel that, well, now I've got to read another book. And, you know, now I think there's a happy medium here for some series. I think like Harry Potter, you know, they were all, they kind of all ended open-ended somewhat. But those were fantasy, sci-fi. I mean, there was an author I met a few years back who did a series of young adult books about a novel about a vampire named Vladimir Todd. And he starts at, every book is another year of school. He starts in seventh grade and he's in high school. I think he's in high school now. It's kind of like Kinsey Millhone, the Sue Grafton novels. A is for alibi, B is for this, C is for that. It's also part, it with a series, it also goes to the branding process. I think the danger, the easy thing of someone like Sue Grafton is, you know, the order because of the alphabet. It's easy to figure out which one comes where. With John D. McDonald's Travis McGee series, which are colors, there's absolutely no way to tell which is which, and it doesn't matter at all what order you read them in. And I think that's the definition we all strive for. That sure, a lot of people will read them in order, but the simple fact is it doesn't matter.
Well, Alan Jacobson here. That's very interesting, John, and I agree with just about everything you said. I will add a little bit. Very early in the Karen Vale series, people would ask me, and I'd say it doesn't matter. You know, you could pick them up anywhere in the series. But as the series started to get on, and now the seventh book, The Darkness of Evil, comes out in March, you know, my answer has changed, and that's that, with one exception, and I'll talk about that in a second, you can pick up any of the books and read them because they are designed to be self-contained. But there is depth to the character and the series that you lose. Because as John said, you know, Caitlin matures, evolves, changes as time passes. So does Karen Vale. And I think that's important for a character and for a series for people to feel that this person is real and to get into the world and her characters and her situation and her family. And I think there's something missing if you don't build that type of world for your characters and your series, and I try to take advantage of it. For me, as a writer, I think it's more interesting. I think it's more interesting to see how a relationship evolves with a significant other. I think to see how a child, one thing that my readers really want more of is Karen Vale's son, which I don't write him in unless there's a reason for him to be in the story. But, you know, if there is a novel where her son Jonathan is not involved, readers are saying, you know, I want more of Jonathan. Could you put Jonathan in the next book? So I think they feel this need to see evolution and change just like they experience change in their lives. And, you know, Karen Vale is real to these readers as she is to me. So there should be evolution. Now, there was one, there were two books in my series that I did not have that everything tied up at the end, as John said, the dessert at the end. And it wasn't done on purpose. I actually, while I was doing research at a winery, I learned something that totally changed my whole outlook on the story. And I rewrote my outline, and it became a much, much bigger story. And I thought I just had to do this. It was so exciting. It was so fresh and different. Nobody had ever done it before. I had to get congressional subcommittee approval to have access to this this federal agency and the information that I needed and the people that were doing this stuff. And it was just so exciting to me. It made my job much more difficult. But basically, you know, there's a point where Crush ends and there's something that has started to happen in that story that does not get resolved. The main storyline does get resolved, but there's something that continues on into Velocity.
You know,
a lot of readers. Yeah.
Alan raises,
before I forget, go on.
Alan raises an excellent point. As series age and the heroes within them age, and our baby boomer generation ages, more and more writers are giving their heroes children. I mean, I think Clive Cussler was probably the first to do this to Disaster's results with Dirk Pitt when he gave him twins, and a couple of the worst thrillers ever written. That's another story. The great James W. Hall gave Thorne a son in a couple of his recent books, also with really tragic consequences. Jack Reacher thought he had a daughter in Never Go Back, the book on which the latest Reacher film coming out in a couple of weeks is based upon. It's interesting because it's a dynamic that was very hard to conceive of back in the days of Robert Ludlum and when David Morrell was writing the thrillers that defined the genre. Heroes were defined in the moment only by what they did in the books. Even if it was a series, you never really saw evolution. You never saw them grow. James Lee Burke also did this when he had his daughter born, you know, when he adopted an orphan named Alifair, who's actually the same name as his real daughter. And part of the fun of the great Robey Show novels has been watching her grow up. That's a little different than giving a character a child he didn't or she didn't know they had, he or she had, which is the Reacher, Thorne, Dirk, and I think it was also the Dirk Pitt model. So I think this is a function of our own ages, but also the ages of our characters who are uniformly, I think, well, Caitlin is actually fairly young. She's still in her late 30s. I think that's about the same for Karen Vale. But Reacher's in his late 40s now, and Spencer, I remember Robert Parker saying, the biggest mistake he ever made when he created the Spencer series was making Spencer a Korean War vet. Because by the time he was writing the last one before he died, Spencer would have been, if you really figured it out, he would have been in his 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you got to be careful. It's kind of like the staple of the modern day action hero is Vietnam. For many years, every action hero was a Green Beret in Vietnam. But now that would put the character in his mid-60s or later. So now you have the Gulf War, which is not nearly as sexy as Vietnam in so many different ways. There was something about the Vietnam vet, and we still see it occasionally. We still see it once in a while, but more or less now it's the Iraq-Afghanistan first Persian Gulf War. So I don't know. I don't know if anyone else has thought about that. Clearly, Alan, you have.
Yep.
You know, I don't know if the other Alan or if Simon has thought about it.
Well, I'm going to announce my next show for
kids,
next week
actually,
before we start. Go ahead.
I really, really love that angle because, as you guys know, I really try to write the most realistic thrillers ever. And some people love it. Some people don't. Some people like to blow up a helicopter with a handgun. I don't. I really try to do it like we actually do it in the field. And most of my colleagues that were federal agents with me, most of them have kids. And it does change the dynamic of the new action hero, especially when you work as a husband and wife counterterrorism team like I do. I think adding kids to the equation is actually makes them more human and more flawed in certain ways. Of course, they had a tragic accident at the beginning of the Thin Black Line, but I'm not against bringing kids and the fold again, maybe in future books, maybe adoption. I don't know. I really don't know, but I think it brings a vibrant new dimension to the whole thing when your heroes that are, you know, badass actually have kids at home and they're, you know, they like to take care of it and they like to roll around in the ground with them and play with them. I think it gives them a human nature like we actually are in real life.
I have to announce my show for next week before I forget. because we're about 10 more minutes before we're out of time. Not really. Next Tuesday, I have the honor of interviewing Tess Gerrinson. She came over to me. I was honored at the Thriller Fest and said, October 18th, put the date down. We're going to talk about my book and a few other things. And that's a secret. I'm not telling anybody, but this is going to be a really great show. On October 25th and October 27th, this is really amazing, Andrea Kane is celebrating the 25th anniversary of My Heart's Desire and Samantha series, and she wants two interviews the same week. So she's getting it. And on November 2nd, I'm going to interview Ann Traeger, who is the owner and publisher of The French Book. And we're going to talk about the Lafayette Sword and how she translates all her books from French into English. And that's just some of which is coming up. And if those of you want to read something that was really heartfelt, if you ever heard of the Lacey Spears murder, she's in Bedford Hills, and she killed her son, Garnett, by putting poison salt in his feeding tube. My sweet angel, John Klatt, will be there to talk about that and his visit and his in-prison interview with her on November 29th. So before we end, I have one final question. What's next for you, and where do you see your characters going? And I'm...
Sure, John, do you want to start?
Anybody, what's next for you, and where do you see your characters going, and where can we find out more about you and your work?
Okay, Alan Topol, I guess I'll kick it off if that was answering. My next book coming out, Washington Power Play, it's a sequel to The Washington Lawyer, and I'm taking a one-book break from the Craig Page series, and anybody can find about it on my website, www.alantopol.com. That's where I'm headed. So I'll have a book for you in May. You can be sure of that, Fran.
I want it before because I want to read it and just start talking about it. And John Land, when am I getting Michael Torrione? Oh, yay!
That's a topic for another day. Those books are co-written. They're work for hire, and it's a miserable experience. So you'll get another one when I'm paid commiserate to what I'm to the aggravation it takes to write a book. I prefer writing it in, you know, really, I like writing in my own box, not somebody else's, the bottom line. I think that's the beauty and fun of the process. When you start involving third parties, it takes on a Hollywood feel where you can't get anything right because you're trying to conform your vision to somebody else's. So that's the great thing about Caitlin Strong. She's all mine. You know, I think a lot of collaborations can work beautifully, but not all of them do. For Caitlin, she'll be back next year, same time, same channel, in Strong to the Bone. I already teased it a little bit. We've got Nazis. And just to give you a little taste, the book started when I basically wanted to do Nazis, and I'm in Texas because she's a Texas Ranger. So I Googled Nazis in Texas. Gee, took a lot of intelligence, my Brown University education at work, right? Well, I got all these hits. And here's the great thing about being a writer. You never stop learning. I had no idea there were over 100,000 Nazi POWs kept in Texas during World War II, mostly from Rommel's Africa Corps. And the reason they chose Texas to put them in, the Allies, was because according to the laws in those days, of fair war, whatever you want to call it, you tried to settle prisoners in their native environments. In this case, it was the desert. So Texas had all these prisoner of war camps set up throughout mostly the Panhandle and West Texas and areas that were very remote. So I had my book. I knew then that I had my book, but I had no idea. How did any of the three of you know that there were POW camps in Texas in World War II?
Nope.
See?
Nope.
It's kind of like, so that's the jumping off point for Strong to the Bone. And I'm just really starting it now. And since I don't know where it's going, I can't wait to find out.
I'm sure I will. I hope so very soon. Alan Jacobson, what's next for you and my Karen Vale?
So March 7th, put it on your calendar. The Darkness of Evil comes out. It's Karen Vale's seventh novel. And I was very intrigued by the concept of a serial killer having a daughter. So here we get back into a little bit of what Simon and John were talking about of a child, you know, what that does to an individual. Well, what does it do to a serial killer? And what does it do to the daughter of a serial killer? How does she live with this? How does she view her own childhood in retrospect? And what happens if that serial killer who is tucked away in a federal prison suddenly escapes? So that's the jumping off point of Darkness of Evil. I love it. It's a very exciting novel. It explores some things that most of us haven't thought about in the past, kind of like Nazis in Texas. And so that's March 7th. You will be getting your galley very shortly, Fran.
Oh, that's even better. That's even better. I have so many books inside, and then when I get all of yours, I put them aside and say, you guys got to wait. I've got at least 75 inside that are staring at me, seriously. And yours go into the read right now pile, then there's the read whenever pile, then there's the pile that says you're not getting done ever. God, I don't read everything.
I love it.
I really just have to be honest. I have a book on income tax, and I promised the publicist I would read it, but actually I'm going to read it when I get – I really don't want to know about the IRS right now. Alan Topol, where can we find out more? We had you. Simon, what's next for you? I don't want to leave anybody out.
Well, it's really exciting because on November 1st, my next book, The Red Dotted Line, is coming out, and I think it's my best work yet. It's set in Russia and in Syria. There's two different plot lines. There's a Zima that's going after Mike's father that was kidnapped by the Sheik. And there's Mike and Lisa once again working together to stop biological attack on American soil. And a cool thing about it is that if you buy the book between now and I believe it's November 30th, your name will be entered to win a trip to the Bahamas for two, airfare included. So it's really, really cool. And I think for the people that really enjoyed my debut, The Thin Black Line, they'll love A Red Dotted Line. So that's what's coming
next.
Go ahead.
I love your pictures on Facebook, too, of all your trips, so I get to go there because I'll never get to go there. So I really like to share
my travel experience with my reader. You know, I have a great time doing it. And and I'm presently working on A Thick Crimson Line that's coming out on November 2017, and it's exploring the danger of sleeper cells that are already embedded into our government officials.
Now, that sounds interesting. I think I'm going to be very, very busy reading, and this explains my eye strain constantly, because unfortunately for me, when I get one of your books, well, four of you, I just sit down and read them. I'm not supposed to do that, but I do it anyway. So the next day, I can't read. So I want to thank everybody, and
Fran, let me just tell you where you can get information on my books.
Oh, I'm sorry, Alan, go on.
I left that out. So you can go to alanjacobson.com, and it probably helps to spell it right, though. The others should work, but alanjacobson.com. My newsletter's there. You can sign up and get a free ebook that I co-authored with one of the FBI profilers on staying safe and personal safety.
That's interesting, because I intend to write my 14th book, which is going to be called Revenge and Retribution, told from the point of view of the dead person behind the gravestone. And it's interesting. And I did do a blog tour in July and August, and I did get some really great reviews, and the people at Partners in Crime, I think, John, you know. As a matter of fact, John, I should tell you that I am going to be part of your blog tour, because I read Strong Cold Dead, and Cheryl and Gina and Wendy don't let up with me. They send me the books even if I don't want to be on the blog, so they send it anyway. So I volunteered to be on yours. Whatever date they tell me I'm supposed to post your review again of Strong Cold Dead, I'll probably post it 10 more times. Because if those of you that never work with them, they're fantastic. They really are. They do an unbelievable job for me and for everyone. And they're reasonable. And because I do reviews for them, they're even more reasonable, to be very honest. So I hope to do this again very soon. I think my next panel show is going to be on voice, character voice, and point of view. And how do you write your in first person, third person, second person narrative? And do you use italics like Alan did, which made it easy for me to follow the backstory? So that was going to be one of my ideas that are coming up pretty soon as a panel show, voice and point of view. And I'm also going to do point and counterpoint. How does your character act one way? What would happen if the character was told to do just the opposite? It's just my, yeah, it's different, right?
Yeah.
I didn't say it was good. And I have a few other ideas in my book inside, and I am going to ask maybe next time. It's very hard to get Brad Meltzer. Steve Berry, maybe, but Andrew Gross said he would like to do a panel show also.
Wonderful.
And that would be amazing. So I would like to thank everybody. And I will be in touch when I have the next panel show, whenever I decide, when everybody's available, I hope in January, after
Sounds
the new
great.
Year, to do another one. And I want to thank you very much, and I would like to thank Hurricane Matthew for leaving. I don't know how many of you had it, but it was horrible. And we're very happy that he's gone, and hopefully won't do too much more damage in the Bahamas. That's really sad what's happening over there and in Haiti. So everybody have a beautiful day. Have a nice day, and thank you guys so much. This has been really interesting, and have a nice day, and bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.